From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. We never tire of the Beatles. You know, I just love to hear their story told, and I read most of the Beatle books. We've had several shows devoted to them here on From the Bookshelf. And tonight we're joined by Philip Norman, whose book, Shout, The Beatles in Their Generation, was first published in 1981. When John Lennon was murdered in December 1980, I was devastated. It was just not the way that story was supposed to end. Some wonderful part of the Beatles' magic died with him, the comic and delightful part. I thought for a while that I'd never be able to listen to the music again. But the following summer, Shout arrived, and in its pages I was able to travel back to Liverpool and see the birth of the Beatles and be with them as they rose to the toppermost of the poppermost. In some way, it was the perfect solace for my grief, and I've dipped back into it many times over the years. Philip Norman revised it a few years ago, and I gave it another reading then. And he's also written fine books on Buddy Holly and the Rolling Stones and Elton John. Now he returns to our heroes with a new book entitled John Lennon, The Life, an exhaustive study of the brief life of the man for whom the Liverpool airport is named. And he joins us tonight from Liverpool. So I'm very happy to say, Philip Norman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Why write about John Lennon again? I mean, you've written Shout, which is a marvelous book, and so why go back to it now?
Well, Shout was a collective portrait, and it was a sketch, really, of John in a group. I felt as time went on that he really deserved a full-length portrait in oils, or just of him. He was such a complex person. I mean, he is a towering presence in the late 20th century. He's still in the world today, not just his music, but his personality is still with us somehow, you know, the humorous, funny, sort of scurrilous, very honest personality that he was. And I felt if I went back and looked, there was much more to say about John. Indeed, that so it proved.
Since John's death, I think there's a tendency for people to kind of lionize John to a certain extent, and often at Paul McCartney's expense, and I think there was some of that even in Shout, which I presume that you started writing Shout before John's death and finished it after. Is that so?
That's true. I sort of left it open at the end of that book because I had a feeling that because John was, you know, coming back from his retirement, that I would be able to go across and talk to him. And then the news came. Actually, my publisher had the manuscript of the book that John had been killed. But then, ironically, 5 months later, when the book came out, I was in New York, and Yoko invited me to the apartment to see where John had been living, and I saw the place really as he had left it. But yes, I mean, I felt I was just, you know, I was horribly too late, but still one could feel his presence in that place, and, you know, it had meant so much to him, that last home.
Well, now, of course, at least I would say maybe two-thirds of the life of John Lennon includes all the things that you talked about in Shout. So how much of what's in Shout is, did you cannibalize Shout, or is it completely new?
Not at all. I made a promise to myself that I must not do that. I must not recycle anything I'd written before. Obviously, some of the same events, many of the same events have to be covered. But in this case, John is center stage and the Beatles are sort of to the side because, you know, the Beatles became a kind of distraction for John and, you know, an annoyance for John. He wanted more than just to be in the Beatles. Also, I tried to look at everything afresh, every single song that he had recorded, every sort of day. I tried to make, you know, a new interpretation and try and look at it in a fresh way, even very iconic moments.
Well, your perspective on Paul and also Yoko seems different now than in 1981. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. The perception was that I was anti-Paul McCartney. I mean, I never thought I was. The worst thing I ever said about him was that he wasn't always as charming as he appeared to be. That's true of anybody. But certainly, I feel I did undervalue his talent and also his importance to John's talent in Shout. So I have tried to make amends for that in this book. Obviously, yes, Yoko. I was granted access to Yoko for this new book, and I began to realize how much she was misjudged at the time, particularly in Britain. I mean, how much really horrible racism was thrown at her, racial abuse was thrown at her, and how very she really was what John needed. John always had to have a sidekick. He always had to have someone to sort of bounce his ideas off and to challenge and encourage him. But Yoko was the perfect person to realize John's ambitions to be more than a musician. He wanted to be a real, as he put it in quotes, a real artist. And Yoko said, you can be what you want to be. You can be yourself. You don't have to be locked up in this smiling and bowing collective image of the Beatles. Yoko was his escape from that.
Well, so you've written thousands of words about, thousands of pages about the Beatles and about John Lennon. How did you first become involved with them?
Well, I first became involved by thinking, or uninvolved by thinking, there are so many people out there writing thousands of words about the Beatles. There's no room for me at all. There's no point in my trying to write anything about them. I was thrown out of their dressing room as a local journalist in Britain in 1965 by Neil Aspinall, the roadie,
yeah.
Having talked to John and Ringo and then Paul, and they were incredibly nice, all three of them. And I said, oh, can I hang around a bit longer? And they said, oh, sure, you know. And then Neil came and said, out. That was the formula. So the Beatles never looked bad. But then in 69, when they were really just breaking up and, you know, the world was wondering what was going to happen with John and Yoko and the other Beatles, I was allowed to be around the Apple House in London for several weeks, and I was allowed to come and go really as I pleased, and granted amazing freedom within the house to sit and watch what was happening, including spending a morning in John and Yoko's office when they were like a helpline to the world. People were just coming in and asking for money or support or their endorsement of this or that project or charity or something. And I was allowed to sit there and watch them. And so it wasn't until years later that I thought of a biography of the Beatles, and everyone said, you're mad, everybody knows everything there possibly is to know about the Beatles. But of course, when I looked, particularly in Liverpool, and then sort of followed their progress, you know, from Liverpool, there was so much information that had never come out. And that's true of this book on John as well, you know, that if one goes back to the source and starts afresh, there is so much to say still about him, about his, particularly about his character and all its contradictions.
In John Lennon, the life about John's parents than we've ever read before.
Yes, because John went through life with a terrible feeling of loss and sort of deprivation, because neither his mother nor his father were fully in his life when he was a child. His father, who was painted in a very bad light, as sort of ne'er-do-well, who sort of walked out on John, was not really as bad as that. He wasn't a strong character, but he wanted to keep the family together, but he gave up John to John's mother, Julia, thinking that would be the best thing for John. And it really had a terrible effect on his father. His father, Alfred, later Freddie Lennon, really never had a proper job after that and sort of sank into being almost an itinerant and sort of wandering around Britain doing menial sort of jobs. John's mother, Julia, then handed John on to her elder sister, Aunt Mimi, who brought John up with great, tremendous efficiency and tremendous care and concern and commitment. John's mother, Julia, was living nearby, and John saw a lot of her, but she never seemed really his, because she lived with another man and had two children with another man. So he felt that both his mother and his father, in their different ways, had sort of walked out on him. And it, particularly his mother, who was very beautiful and very eccentric, she wasn't like a mother. She was more like a sort of flirtatious older cousin. And John, even at one point, sort of wondered in his own mind if there might have been a sort of sexual encounter between the two of them one day when they were alone together in the house. Very soon after that, his mother was killed by a motorist outside Aunt Mimi's house in Liverpool. And this was a devastating blow to John, but it left this sort of tantalizing question in his mind. He never got over this, thinking about whether he might on that one occasion have somehow, you know, suddenly become sexually involved with his mother. And he was talking about it to the end of his life over and over again. And of course, in his music, his mother is a recurring theme in songs that are so full of pain that one can hardly listen to them even today.
Yes, you occasionally refer to his Julia voice, in that he sang that particular song in a different way than other songs.
Yes, like a sort of lost child, really, but also the song Mother, which is a sort of lament for both his mother and his father, and the sense of loss that he felt. I mean, that is almost impossible to listen. It is so full of pain and anguish, and, you know, John put everything, he put his whole self into everything he sang, but never more so, I think, than in those songs.
Your Freddie Lennon appears in your book quite a bit, and the relationship he has with John is pretty complex. Whatever became of him?
Well, having had these sort of years and years in obscurity and poverty, he suddenly John was famous. The reason his father really wanted to contact him was not to sort of get money out of him, as is generally sort of said and written, but he wanted to put right this idea that John had, that his father had sort of just walked out on him, and it was much more complicated than that. His father had made quite heroic efforts to keep the family together. And then his father sort of came in and out of his life when John was famous. John's attitude was sometimes colored by, you know, the substances he was ingesting at the time. But really, it wasn't till the very end, when his father was diagnosed with cancer in the mid-70s, that they had a real sort of reconciliation. But his father actually found happiness, because his father married a much younger wife and had two children with her, and really found a measure of happiness at the end, which was nothing much to do with John's sort of largesse as a famous Beatle. Freddie sort of found his own happiness.
We're talking with Philip Norman, and his new book is the mammoth biography of John Lennon called John Lennon, The Life. Cynthia Lennon was here on our show, and she painted a rather unflattering portrait of John's Aunt Mimi. What's your take on Mimi?
Well, she was a wonderful woman. She was like one of those sort of tough women in Charles Dickens' novels, like Betsy Trotwood in David Copperfield. Not very sort of, you know, not very demonstrative as a surrogate parent to John. I mean, not very maternal, but organized his life and gave him absolutely everything. In a way, although John felt that he had a deprived childhood, in many ways his childhood was very secure and very happy, because Mimi absolutely lavished every possible care and attention on John. She would regularly pawn her diamond wedding ring to get John a proper school uniform, to go to school, to a good school. His meals were always on the table. She gave him lots of pocket money. But he was looking for more sort of softer, sort of more maternal presence. And his mother was not didn't provide that either. She was fascinating and tantalizing. Cynthia Powell, as she was when John met her, was a very sweet person who just sort of, you know, just gave John this kind of sweetness that he needed, this kind of femininity. And for a long time, you know, that was enough. But the more famous John became, the more he saw of the world, the less, you know, satisfying his relationship with Cynthia was.
Let's talk about, I guess, I'm not sure which is the most important relationship in Lennon's life, but I guess for us, it's Paul McCartney. So what about that relationship?
Well, it was extraordinary because on one level, it was quite sort of, it wasn't a close emotional relationship. It was a relationship of two people who were incredibly professional and recognized the quality of the other. Because although they were very different people, they could switch personalities as songwriters. Now, songwriting teams very rarely have both members writing words and music, as Lennon McCartney did. I can't think of another example offhand. But they would write together initially, because they were just writing for the hit parade, trying to write hits. As they evolved in talent, they would write separately. But each could always help the other with a song in a crucial way. And one would go to the other and say, oh, this song needs something else, and the other one would just provide it. So they were amazingly adept at sort of switching characters in a way that, to me, is summed up by the fact that Paul was a left-handed guitarist, but John could play Paul's left-handed guitar and vice versa. So they could slip into the personality of the other. And McCartney just gave so much to John creatively, and John did to Paul. And John always acknowledged this, even when the Beatles were sort of were quarreling about who should manage them and about their business. When John wanted to record the ballad of John and Yoko, it was to Paul McCartney that he turned, and the two of them did it between them, really, because the other two Beatles weren't around at the time. So they never really lost that, and McCartney to this day, you know, acknowledges, you know, the enormous debt that each one owed the other. If you think of John's masterpiece, I suppose it must be A Day in the Life, which is like John's De Profundis by Oscar Wilde, which has a very cold and lonely and detached sort of atmosphere that makes the shivers run up your spine. But then in the middle, there's the very chatty everyday bit by Paul about got up, fell out of bed, woke up, fell out of bed. And the song just wouldn't be the song it is without that middle passage by Paul.
And what about their personal interaction with each other? Did they love each other?
I don't think it was love. It was a tremendous sort of mutual respect, but they never really had a terrible row, not face to face. You think of other bands, and you know when trouble breaks out and there's fists flying and God knows what. But John and Paul never had a sort of stand-up furious row together. That their relationship was very durable, and it did last through the Yoko coming into the studio and John leaving Cynthia and his son Julian to go off with Yoko, and the only sort of the only sort of bitterness came when they started making solo records, and Paul made a slightly sort of derogatory reference to John, and John replied with this nuclear strike called "How Do You Sleep?" You know, implying that Paul ought to be losing sleep because of his behavior, which was not true. You know,
the only thing you did was yesterday. And
yes, I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, and John never meant it and could never have thought that. But actually, as people, they never really had a terrible row.
Speaking with Philip Norman, and his new book is a biography of John Lennon, and he's the author of Shout, The Beatles and Their Generation, one of the great Beatle books of the 10,000 645 Beatle books there are out there. He's also written books on Buddy Holly and the Rolling Stones and Elton John. And there's actually a connection between all of those subjects and John Lennon. I mean, Buddy Holly inspired the name of the Beatles. The Rolling Stones certainly play a role. If not for Lennon and McCartney, I guess they would never have become songwriters. And
it's true.
And Elton John appears in your book also.
That's true. It's all part of the same story, which is the story of British pop music. And it so much does come from Buddy Holly, because Buddy Holly was like a teacher to these British boys. They listened to Elvis Presley and they loved the sound of Elvis, but they couldn't understand how the records were made. They seemed to come from a sort of alien planet. Buddy Holly, the songs that Buddy Holly sent to Britain could instantly be deciphered. They could tell which chords Buddy was using. They were very simply constructed, and you know that you could take them to pieces and put them together again if you were a British little British skiffle group. And so skiffle groups turned into rock bands because of Buddy, and this was true of the people who became the Rolling Stones, and it was true of the Beatles, and it was true of so many others like Eric Clapton and The Who and goodness knows how many great British pop bands of the 60s. Then Elton John came along at the tail end of the Beatle era, and his manager was Dick James, who was the Beatles' music publisher. So Dick James had these two fantastic strokes of luck in his life. Even when Elton was starting out, Elton thought he would wear glasses to be like Buddy Holly. In fact, his eyesight was fine. In fact, he ruined his eyesight by wearing glasses. So it's just one narrative, really. The Stones and the Beatles, who were the great rivals in the 60s, actually were very, very good friends and liked each other a lot. And the joke is that the Beatles were marketed as these cuddly, family-friendly mop tops, whereas actually they'd been quite rough, particularly in the Hamburg era. John Lennon was like Johnny Rotten on stage in Hamburg. He was like an embryo punk. Whereas the Stones, who were quite sort of middle-class, well-behaved, serious jazz, blues people, they were marketed as the Antichrist. So each one was sort of playing a role opposite to their true nature.
You say it sort of galls John Lennon when Satisfaction came out, because I guess it was he wanted to be the one to say all those things.
Yes, the Stones starting to be outrageous, you know, did make John kind of chafe about the fact that, the Beatles had been so smartened up. But then the Beatles started out when, you know, there was no rock culture. It was still old-fashioned show business, and the superstition still existed that rock music would be over in a few months. You know, they thought they only had a few months at the top. The Stones were more sort of, you know, the world was moving more to a perception that youth had its own culture and its own heroes and anti-heroes. But at the same time, John felt that the Stones were sort of, they were always one step behind the Beatles and copying the Beatles, which of course is true.
Let me just ask you about one other relationship in John's life, and that's Brian Epstein.
Well, Brian Epstein was homosexual at a time of great repressiveness in Britain, when homosexual activity was illegal. You could be imprisoned for it. So it had to be a secret side of this very cultured young man who was in his middle and later 20s. So that was not the age when people listened to pop music. So Brian was more into classical music and opera. But he saw the Beatles. He was his family's record and electrical store in Liverpool. And the Beatles were exciting to him as a gay man, really, because they were young boys in black leather prancing around, and he went in for very dangerous liaisons with straight men, really tough straight men, and this was a kind of way of his fantasies being harmless. He was in love with John Lennon, not with Paul, the pretty one, but with John, the sort of faux tough one. And John did really exploit this, there's no doubt about it, the fact that Brian did adore him. But then there was also an affinity between them, because Britain was still very much ruled by class in those days, and John really was of the middle class in his upbringing by Aunt Mimi, and so was Brian. So they were sort of, you know, they had that in common as well. And there was always a bit of a special relationship between John and Brian on that level too.
And I guess like other important people in John's life, Brian Epstein cut out on him there, right, kind of in the middle of the story.
Well, John, it's a sort of, John always felt people abandon him by dying. He always felt it on that subjective or selfish level. And yes, he would say people keep dying on me. And of course, Brian tragically was found dead in 1967, just on the sort of fringe, you know, of the sort of psychedelic era and the druggy era. And John did feel, because Brian, in a way, had been a sort of father figure, although he was only a few years older than John, he had made life so protected for the Beatles. He was like a parent as much as a manager. And once that protective shield was gone, then nothing really went right for them, in their career. There were terrible ups and downs. The music was still became brilliant and more brilliant, but it was very turbulent. You know, it was like they'd had a lucky charm in the eyes of the world, and that just was taken away.
Well, in your research for your book, and it's a massive book. I don't know, it's about 900 pages or so. Who did you talk to that you hadn't spoken to for Shout, or did you go back and visit some people again? And
I did some people. George Martin, who talked to me when I did Shout, he said, "Well, what can I tell you that I didn't tell you before?" And I said, "Oh, would you please try?" We met at his studio, which is quite near my home in London, and he gave me the most marvelous description of John writing a song, how John would put a song together, which certainly I had never heard and certainly never written. Paul McCartney very generously talked to me by email, gave me very full answers on very big questions, like the question of whether John really had kicked Stuart Sutcliffe in the head during a drunken assault in Hamburg, which may have led to the fact that Sutcliffe died from a brain hemorrhage.
This was reported a few years ago in Stuart Sutcliffe's sister's book.
That's right. Well, the only alleged witness was McCartney, and McCartney said he had no memory of such a thing. You would not, I believe, forget that if you had seen it. So I saved the very big questions to ask him, but he was very, very helpful. Neil Aspinall, who was the Beatles' original roadie and then became the boss of the Apple organization, who never talked to anybody on principle, did agree to talk to me. So I was very, very fortunate that he did, because unfortunately he died early this year. So, with still a great deal more to say, which I think he might have written in his own memoirs. But he did talk to me very honestly and had a very special relationship with John and very, very great affection for John. There were some members of John's family who don't really talk to people, his cousins who had very, very, warm memories of John that had never, ever surfaced before. So there is a degree of luck, of course, when one writes a biography, and I think I did have my share of luck.
Well, in both of your books, I wonder, did you ever speak with Pete Best?
I did in the first book. I had a long, long talk with Pete Best, because the Pete Best sort of story brings an almost Gilbert and Sullivan sort of twist, because he was fired from the Beatles, as we know, just on the eve of their breakthrough. Not because he was a bad drummer, most people think, but because he just didn't fit in sort of with the group sort of ethos. But his mother had been running had been a sort of manager before Brian Epstein came along, and Neil Aspinall had an affair with Pete's mother, and she bore a son to Neil. So I mean, this was a tremendous extra complication about firing Pete Best. It is like Gilbert and Sullivan.
It's a very strange and complicated and marvelous story, and nobody tells it better than my guest, Philip Norman, and his new book is called John Lennon, The Life. Philip Norman, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Ms. Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody.